Hey, y'all. Anita here. One of the best things about being on the 2018 JOCO cruise was getting the chance to sit down on a giant boat and talk to some amazingly creative people. I hope you enjoy listening to these special conversations as much as I loved having them. We're releasing one a week as a special bonus for you amazing listeners. And remember, we do need your help to keep making this podcast, so please consider joining our podcast community for exclusive perks and bonus content at d.rip/femfreak. This week's interview is with showrunner Amy Berg. The interview is far too short for dumb reasons, so we've got to get her back on sometime.
Hi, Amy Berg.
Hi, how are you, buddy?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm fabulous.
How are you feeling being on a cruise ship?
Well, right now we're in an interior room.
Please describe it.
It's got what looks to be a window because there's shades in front of it, but then when you pull it back, it's actually a wall.
Yep. It is a room that has no bed. It's like literally an interrogation room. It's very bizarre.
Yes, and we're near the front of the ship, which is apparently the most dizzying. So
yeah, we're barely holding it together.
Yeah,
we're going to record this special podcast
bonus.
We're
going to kill it.
Amy Berg.
Yes.
You are a screenwriter.
I am.
For the big and small screens.
Uh-huh.
How exciting is that?
It's not a bad job, I have to say.
You've worked on some really exciting shows that I think our fans would be interested in hearing about. Y'all, we're on a ship and we just don't know how language works anymore. So you wrote for Person of Interest, Eureka, my personal favorite, Leverage, which is all I really want to talk about.
Talk about Leverage all you want.
Was it wonderful?
It was
to work
wonderful.
On it?
Yeah.
It seemed like such a good show. I mean, it was a good show, but it seemed like it was a fun project.
Yeah, it was a great cast. I mean, we can't ask for a better group of people. And I borrowed a bunch of them when I did a digital series called Caper a while ago. I just like called everybody and was like, "Hey, can you do this for me on the side?" And John Rogers is an awesome showrunner to work with, and he gave me a few more tools to add to my toolbox. So
that's
that was
awesome.
Great. Yeah.
Well, so how did you Sci-fi, it's not the only thing you work on, but you've done a lot of work in the sci-fi, sort of fantasy-ish, weird,
for sure.
Not real reality.
I would say that's
world.
What I'm most known for.
Yeah. Like, how did you get into, like, it's not an easy business to break into. So what was your history here?
I have a really kind of crazy breaking in story. When I moved to L.A., 1998, I got a job as an assistant on some Nickelodeon shows in their last, final seasons, all that, in Kenan and Kel. Buffy was on at the time, and
yes.
I just, was the best show ever.
I'm really glad that my co-hosts are not here doing this interview.
Yeah.
Because they are blasphemers. They've never seen Buffy, nor will they watch it, because I'm so upset that I somehow hired people who have never watched Buffy.
Oh my gosh.
So take that, Ebony and Carol.
Wow, you guys are so screwed.
They're so screwed.
Wait until you hear this story. So I wrote a spec of Buffy. I didn't know what a spec was at a time. I just wrote a script that I thought they should make. Because I thought I should be writing for Buffy, because I was, kind of arrogant coming out of school and didn't know anything, which is sort of, the best way to break in, is just not know anything and do crazy stuff. So I wanted to send this script to Joss Whedon and say, hey, bring me onto the show. I feel like I should be writing for you. And the Nickelodeon producers that I worked with were like, no, he can't even read a script of his own show. There's legality issues. And so I wrote instead a one-act play that had Joss and the cast of Buffy as characters talking about how awesome I was. and how it'd be a shame if they didn't have an opportunity to meet and read me. And I had the prop guys at Nickelodeon whittle some vampire steaks, and I bought some fake vampire teeth, and I put it all in a box, and I sent it off to Joss Whedon's office. 2 days later, his assistant called and says, Joss needs to meet you right away.
Wow.
So my very first meeting in town was with Joss Whedon when I was 22 on Buffy. And so I pitched him a bunch of ideas. Didn't end up getting hired. I think they went with someone people know very little about, Jane Espenson.
Yeah.
Or possibly Drew Goddard. It was one of those two, I think, who actually got the job. But when I got back to Nickelodeon, they were sort of, you know, they were kind of impressed that I was able to secure a meeting with a guy that they also idolized. And so they asked me if I had any ideas for the Nickelodeon shows that I was working on. So I pitched them a couple ideas, and they bought a couple, and then they brought me on staff.
Oh, cool.
And so my first job in town was writing for, you know, half-hour comedies for Nickelodeon. And then I had, you know, it's not really what I wanted to be writing. You know, obviously, if Buffy is my thing, then I'm much more into sort of supernaturally sci-fi, one-hour type stuff. And so I ended up, what got me into, science fiction was I wrote a Lost spec during the first season of Lost. And, while they were doing all the sort of the POV episodes, where they would just take a character and do their backstories and then how they got to the island and all of that, I wrote a script that was from the point of view of the dog. And it was a script that got passed around town a lot, and I became sort of the dog lady. Oh, you wrote the dog spec.
Wow. Yeah.
And I got like offers on like every show that was trying to take off on the success of Lost. There was like six or seven shows that year that were trying to, you know, simulate that success. And I got offers on almost all of them. So that's how I sort of segued from running half hours to running 1 hour.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So it's just crazy. You just annoyed people a lot.
I was really good at not knowing what was inappropriate.
Yeah. And I feel like that's not a totally uncommon story. Like there are other people who made their break just by being really persistent. We call it persistence.
Persistence.
Sure. Or annoyance. Yeah. So I think that for a lot of folks, we understand writers' rooms exist, but we don't really know like what that means or what that looks like. And I, like, can you describe what it's like to make an episode of a show?
Sure.
Briefly?
Yeah. 20 years in 2 minutes. Let me do this.
Yeah.
As a showrunner now, my job is to sort of bring the room together. So, hiring writers is like casting.
What are you a showrunner on?
I was running a show called Counterpart, which is on the air right now on Stars, starring J.K. Simmons.
Nice.
Which is we're 100% fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, by the way. So, you know, not so bad.
That's impressive.
It's a good show.
Yeah.
So, you know, as a showrunner, my job is to hire a staff and to run a writer's room and to then also supervise all aspects of, pre-production, post-production, and the actual shooting, itself. But as far as the writer's room goes, you know, it's like casting. You have to hire sort of the right mix of humans. So there's, you know, try to avoid sort of personality clashes or, any sort of political thing. And it's really sort of a top-down philosophy where, you know, it's the showrunner who sets the tone for the entirety of the room. And personally, I like, you know, I sort of treat every idea as equal, no matter who it's coming from, whether it's from someone who has 20 years experience or who has, you know, 2 months experience. And that way, no one feels intimidated to share their ideas in a creative free, safe space.
Would it be fair to say that's not traditional?
Yeah, I mean, I've been around a lot of rooms, and I've, you know, the ones I've not run, certainly politics play huge roles, even on shows that you might specifically love as well.
What?
What?
I don't say anything bad about
every show. Every show has its own set of politics.
There were a couple seasons in there that were a little messy.
I was only on seasons 1 and 2 of Leverage.
Oh, well, season 1 was the best season, so hey.
I would agree. but yeah, no, it's really sort of like, you know, you gotta... It's so collaborative. TV is so collaborative. It's really the opposite of screenwriting, of movie writing.
Okay.
In that, like, you break stories together. You come up with the ideas for character arcs, season-long arcs, and the plot for individual episodes all together in this room. You assign the episodes, and then people go off and write them.
Okay.
And then they come back to you, and you do your own sort of pass on them to make sure all of the voices are consistent and it sounds like
the showrunner does the pass. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that when we see like wild inconsistencies in episodes of shows, that like the showrunner is not doing their job properly.
Well, I mean, and a lot of that is due to a lack of time. Sure. Like if you're looking at like a broadcast network show, like, I mean, the production train on those shows eat up scripts so quickly, you don't really have a chance to get them into the proper shape.
Okay.
It could be as the time constraints could be such that, you know, you're turning in a script on a Tuesday and it shoots the next day.
How do the actors learn their lines?
They become very, very well trained where they're like, you know, at night after they get home, you know, or in the trailer while they're not actually shooting, they're constantly learning their lines. And how they do it is, I don't know, miraculous. They must have their own sort of like secret tips that they share amongst themselves about how to speed memorize. I can't do it.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds so stressful.
Yeah, I know.
So I'm curious, like, you know, we're talking, there's been for a long time and continuing conversation about inclusivity in mm-hmm. Hollywood, how, you know, like there's these old dinosaurs and like white dude executives that are calling, like making all these decisions, and how we need to weed them out and bring in new voices. Like, what are you seeing? So, okay, so there's that. And mm-hmm. then the other piece is, it seems and it feels like there are more representations of different people.
Yeah.
On, especially in TV and film, especially in TV, but also in film. And so we're seeing more, you know, like Black-led programming. We're seeing more people of color, more women in general, programming that is not just like white dude stories again and again.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sort of in this place where is it that we have more content, quote unquote, in general, because we absolutely do, and that this is still just the margin of error? Or does it actually feel like change is happening, that like more people of different backgrounds are getting into writers' rooms and getting into director roles and being able to make stories outside of the norm?
Yeah, I think it's a combination. I think some of it is within the margin of error, which is scary. I think because there's so much content because of the streaming platforms, whether it's, you know, from YouTube Red to, you know, Amazon to Netflix to Hulu, and then all of, you know, pay cable, basic cable, broadcast network. If it was up to the broadcast networks, I think we would still be stuck in the hole. But it's really, I think, streaming and pay cable that have sort of branched out and realized that there are far more audience out there than their programming is targeting. And, you know, and stars I've worked with for the last 6 years, and they have, you know, Power and Survivor's Remorse, and they've really sort of hooked into a Black audience that was underrepresented on TV, and they're doing really well. But, you know, also to some extent, I think now there is more representation and people are trying. There's a lot of sort of initiatives that those of us are trying to work, you know, from the inside out. Those of us who are women or minority showrunners are making sure that our staffs are more inclusive and that our casting is more inclusive.
Do you communicate with each other?
Like, we
do. Across shows? Like, is there...
Yeah, I mean, there's not like secret cabals necessarily.
What?
I mean, there's only.
I mean, there is a feminist Illuminati. You should get in on that.
I mean, there's been three, but like, I'm saying, I mean, not. It's not like a regular. It's not like a monthly thing.
All right.
But there is a cabal. No, we do sort of talk regularly, and we try to figure out amongst ourselves like how we can be better, and how we can see more, and you know, and it's like the conversations that I have with, you know, casting agents constantly is, you know, I want to see more diverse candidates. And because if it was, you know, left up to them entirely, like you're going to get the same actors over and over and over again. And they're normally white guys. And I've sort of taken the tack of specifying in script what these characters are. Because if you just say, you know, veterinarian, you're going to get a bunch of white guys. So I say, you know, a Latina, you know, veterinarian is what I'm looking for. And so they specifically then have to go out and look for that. But if it's sort of, you know, if it's, you know, not specified, then you're just going to get this, you know, their friends, or, you know, it's, you really have to sort of, you have to work at it.
Yeah.
I wish it wasn't that way, but you do.
When you create these characters, are you seeing more creations? Because one of the problems is that when, like, Hollywood was paying lip service to these issues previously, there was the quote-unquote diversity initiatives where it's, like, one person that reads through scripts and is like, we can turn this white guy into a black guy. Cool.
Yeah.
Right, without taking into account, like, the personal experiences of living as a black person in whatever the environment is that's being told, right? Are you seeing, so instead of just the gender swapping and race swapping that's really superficial, are you seeing more opportunities to create characters like from the ground up that are of different backgrounds that might be trans or might have disabilities or what have you?
Yeah, 100%. 100%. I mean, I feel like there's an openness to not just, you know, the people telling those kinds of stories, but amongst executives to hear those kinds of stories. We've never before been sort of asked to bring in specific things that, you know, that appeal to a certain audience or not. I mean, like, it's always been, you know, best idea wins, you know, like, but now we've sort of like, you know, we're really looking to sort of attract a certain audience. Can you bring us something that's a little more specific? And it really opens up the door to a lot of different sort of origin stories for characters, and just in general being a little more inclusive with, you know, from a creative standpoint.
So last question. Mm-hmm. You were on a panel this morning called Modes of Storytelling.
Yes.
With John Scalzi.
I'm still not sure what that means exactly.
Sure, I didn't. It was not made clear on the panel.
No, either. I didn't.
It was
think
a great,
so.
But it was actually a really good panel. It was with John Scalzi, Will Wheaton, and
Mike Eagle. Yeah.
Yes. So the panel was really interesting, and it was, you know, different kinds of, like, each of you had different mediums in which you mm-hmm. wrote in, right? There was a very tiny bit of that conversation about, like, the future of science fiction, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, dystopian future or hope, or I kind of, like, would like to hear your thoughts about where you think sci-fi is going.
Yeah, it came up that it feels right now that there's just an awful lot of dystopian stuff on the air, and that it feels like it's a reaction to the world we currently live in. But the fact is, all of that stuff was in the pipeline before Donald Trump was elected, and everything went to hell. So I think in reaction to the world we live in, we're going to see sort of a more optimistic view sort of take over when it comes to people creating shows. Like, I feel like there's going to be a new wave a little bit of positivity, or at least, you know, characters who are overcoming adversity, sort of stronger protagonists that aren't necessarily the darker sort of flawed characters, but people who are really sort of overcoming successfully.
So we're going to finally move away from the anti-hero trope that we've become obsessed with?
I was trying not to use that word, but yes.
Over the last 10 years, it was like, we're so tired of vanilla heroes. Let's just make everyone, like, tortured and unlikable, but also sympathetic. So you have to, oh God, it just drives me nuts.
Yeah. So I'm hoping that's the case. Yeah. I'm hoping heroes return, actual heroes.
Let's bring heroes back.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Not the show. Don't bring that back.
Didn't the characters.
Did they try to bring that back?
They did.
Oh, let's not. Let's end it not on that note, but on check out Counterpart. It's your show on Stars.
On Stars, yes.
Show running this amazing show that has 100%.
Yay!
Whatever on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yep. Certified fresh.
Certified fresh. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure chatting with you.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, too.
Hopefully we stop feeling like we're on an ocean soon.
Are we on an ocean?
All right, bye.
Bye.